It's important to remember that none of the contents of this podcast, nor the podcast itself, constitutes any kind of investment advice, nor is it a recommendation that you pursue any investment strategy. This podcast is limited to general information purposes only. Welcome to High Definition by Koji. Koji is an early stage investment firm building the global financial stack.
High Definition illuminates the motives of founders, builders, and creators of a new digital economy.
Hey Joey, welcome to High Definition. It's a pleasure to have you here. So I think it's probably best to start at the very beginning. How did you find your way into computer science?
Yeah, I mean, the way I initially got into it was a long time ago. You know, the very first thing I ever did was when I was like 8 or 9. Somehow I came across this really old like book about, you know, writing HTML. And some like early kind of JavaScript stuff. And so started playing around making websites. And then the next thing I did when I consider it like actual programming is in when I was 10, my dad bought me an old Apple II GS from eBay. Mm-hmm. And he taught me how to write like a couple of basic programs, like literally in the language called BASIC. I think one of them was like, he taught me how to write like a while loop that just repeatedly said, you know, like one phrase over and over. And then kind of after that, I was sort of hooked and started playing around making like small like text-based games and that kind of stuff. That's how I first started programming.
Wow. So you were writing code when you were 10 years old.
Basic stuff, but like super fancy or anything, but yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's still wild though. I mean, I feel like when I was 10, I, you know, definitely wouldn't have been doing that. So it's incredible. Is your dad's background in computers as well? Is that sort of the path into?
Well, so he's an ER doctor, but he's always been, you know, super into technology and stuff, you know, but, you know, he doesn't have like a computer science background or anything. He just kind of always had like the latest, you know, cutting edge tech when we were kids. Like he'd always have, you know, the latest, like, I remember back in the old days, like there wasn't a whole lot to do with computers in the early days. And like, I remember, you know, we'd play around installing different Linux distros. Like that's something like we did for fun as a kid. Like we'd, you know, check out like the difference between like Red Hat or I don't even know if Ubuntu was around back then, but like, you know, Red Hat versus Fedora versus like, you know, Debian or like all these different types of things you could install. We would like, I remember as like a young kid just spending tons of time formatting hard drives and then installing new distros, seeing like what it was like and then like doing it over and over again.
So this was the sort of passion that led you to study computer science at college. Is that sort of the drive to study it?
So studying it, I guess I kind of always just thought that, you know, computers were like the fastest way to like make an impact in the world. You know, if you think about things like, we think about something like government, you know, it's very slow, right? You have to like convince a lot of people, you have to do a lot of stuff, and maybe you can make some small incremental change and it might take 5 to 10 years. But with computers, you can literally just write a piece of software and it's out there and it exists. So like, that's kind of the reason I got into it. And I think definitely, you know, my dad getting me all that stuff was like an important part of that.
Yeah. And I also noticed that you did drop out of college. Was there something about college that was just too slow paced for you? Or yeah, what was the reason for dropping out there?
Yeah, it's interesting. So like when people know that I dropped out, they commonly ask, you know, like, a lot of people are like, oh, like, you know, did you not like college or did you hate college? Like, no, like it was great, actually. I loved it. Yeah. I love, you know, learning stuff. But I just felt that like there was other stuff that I think was like, I just needed to do. So like, for instance, I thought that crypto is going to be, you know, as big as the internet, but for finance. And, you know, I sort of became convinced that like, if I didn't drop out now and start something, start doing stuff in this space, it might be too late by the time I graduated. Now, obviously that part, that last part of the sentence, completely wrong. Like it's still not too late. But I am still glad that I dropped out and jumped into the space when I did. I would say like the moment when I decided that I wanted to drop out was like, I wrote this game, a game where you'd fly a paper airplane around an obstacle course, and it got like 3,000 downloads in Japan, like in a week with like zero marketing or anything. And that was kind of like, that's kind of like, you know, like, that's like addicting, that feeling. And so that's why I was like, okay, computers are really cool. Like not only can you make this fun stuff, but like people can actually use it. And like, I want to be doing that all the time. Like I don't want to be just sitting around learning theory in CS classes. I want to actually do stuff. And then I looked at the blockchain space and I was like, you know, none of the CS courses are talking about this stuff anyways yet. So I could just join the blockchain space, spend my full time on that. And, you know, I'm not going to learn it in school anyway. So I may as well just drop out.
Right. And so what did you start building?
So initially I started building something pretty stupid. It was a point of sale system with Bitcoin. So you could pay with Bitcoin in stores. There was actually one cool piece of tech we kind of had around that. I found this like professor who had like, he created a way to send information over sound, and he had all this error correcting code around it. So sending the information is not that hard, but getting the error correction right so you can like send it is really important. And I think I just emailed him asking if like I could use it, and he just said sure and like gave me the source code for it. And so I built that I built the point of sale system around that where you could pay with Bitcoin, and instead of using a QR or an NFC, your phone would play a sound and the other device would pick it up. And it's like really hard to hear for your ear, but it works really well. Like you could do it like, you know, 6 or 7 feet away in a room where there's like massive rock music blaring, and it would still work, which like isn't really true for almost any other payment system. Like QRs are clunky. NFC, you kind of have to move your hand around a lot. I still think payments should be done over sound, but like nobody wanted to pay with Bitcoin. So that idea didn't work. That's the first thing.
Yeah, that doesn't sound stupid at all. You premise that as being a stupid invention.
So that was like the first thing. And then so I basically like, I talked to this venture capitalist. I think he's at Google Ventures or something like that. And he gave me some really good advice. He said, you know, like this actually looks pretty cool, but like, you know, there is such a thing as like, you know, market timing, and like this is probably like way too early. So I thought about that for a couple of weeks and then ended up shelving the idea, and then ended up stumbling into like prediction markets. And so that's kind of how initially we started building a prediction market on Bitcoin, which was also a terrible idea, which we can get into if you're curious. And then eventually ended up finding our way to Ethereum in late 2014.
Right. And so maybe go there with prediction markets. What did you initially sort of see as being valuable about them? Why did you feel that they needed to be built? And I guess speak to the raison d'etre for Augur as it first kind of existed.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I got started in betting with horse betting also around when I was 10. These are my two hobbies, writing basic computer programs and betting on horse races. And and so the thing with it is back then, this isn't true anymore, but back then you had to bet on these offshore bookie websites, and a lot of them were not very good. Like if you started winning a lot, they might close your account down. They might freeze your balance. They might, you know, not really pay out a bet they should have. They had all these problems. I didn't really think anything of it beyond that, like, this sucks, you know, and then like fast forward, when I was like, I think I was like 18 when we started working on Augur, maybe 19, you know, then people had started publishing ideas about prediction markets on blockchains. There's a guy, Paul Stork, who published some papers about it. Vitalik had published some papers about it. There's a Princeton paper by this guy, Joseph Banu. I'm sure I'm butchering his last name, but he published a paper as well called Decentralizing Prediction Markets and Limit Order Books. And I read this stuff and I was like, wow, like this is basically the solution to that problem I have with all those offshore bookies. Like you can create these systems that allow you to bet in a way where there's no intermediary, there's no one who can kind of screw you over and steal your money. And it should be like global and mm-hmm. cheaper and all these benefits. And then like kind of fell down the rabbit hole of like, oh, prediction markets are actually like useful information because you have prices about things that exist in the real world, and kind of just fell in love with the idea, basically.
Right. And so you sort of started building it around what time then? You started building Augur around what time?
Yeah. So we started building like, you know, like sort of like a precursor to it. You know, I'd say like September or so of 2014, that was on Bitcoin. And then, you know, probably late November, early to mid-December 2014, we switched to building on Ethereum and really kind of never looked back after that point.
Right. And it was really at the time, probably the first, at least majorly spoken about or adopted decentralized application. So did that dawn on you at the time, or in retrospect, did you kind of contextualize that there's this kind of giant DeFi thing that's emerged now, but you were kind of probably one of the first, you know, to actually build an application on Ethereum?
Yeah, I don't remember if we called it like if we called it decentralized finance or not, but like we knew that's what it was. You know, I don't know if we ever used that term though, but yeah, at the time there was basically us, and then I think shortly after us, or maybe shortly before, you know, it's been a while. There's another project called EtherX, which was like the first decentralized exchange. It never actually launched on mainnet, but that was kind of the other project in the space at the time. So yeah, we were basically the first. Yeah.
And speak to a little bit about the community at that time, like the Ethereum community. Were you going to these conferences? Who were the sort of people that you would run into and share ideas with?
Yeah, so we would definitely go to events. I mean, at the time, there were some Ethereum events, but like back in those days, like you went to Bitcoin meetups. Like, you know, you'd get shot if you talked about something like this at a Bitcoin meetup today. But back then, like, you know, the meetups you went to were Bitcoin meetups, and you would present ideas like Augur at them, and people would be like, oh, that's cool. Like, and people like sort of understood that, like, yeah, you couldn't really build that on Bitcoin. And that's a lot of the events we went to. There was like one Silicon Valley Ethereum meetup that we went to. And there were a couple other Ethereum meetups across the globe that we went to. But in late 2014, early 2015, it was mostly Bitcoin events. Yeah, people are pretty receptive. Like the idea of decentralized Betty markets or decentralized prediction markets, it kind of like naturally jives with people who like decentralized money. I'm sure like once people had money, I haven't actually looked at this in history, and I should have, but I'm sure once people had money, I'm sure one of the first things they did is start betting with it. So it's like it sort of makes sense. But yeah.
Yeah. And what was the sort of the process of growing the team out, finding the team members and sort of cultivating a culture at Augur? I feel like, you know, that's something that may have been pretty hard in the early days.
Yeah, it was definitely tough to find people. It was sort of kind of like random and kind of organic as well. Like most of us met on the internet early on, developer-wise, like finding other developers to work on the project. I mean, early on, it was mostly just, you know, on the dev side, it's mostly myself, this guy, Jack Peterson, who basically started it with me. And then this third guy named Chris Calderon. And, you know, we would just like sit in the same room together and, you know, code from like whenever we woke up, because you didn't set an alarm. You just wake up when you woke up until like maybe 2 to 4 in the morning, depending on whether you debugged the problem you were working on the night before fast enough or not. And then eventually we started hiring more people. I would say one of our best kind of first engineering hires is I found this game developer. This guy named Alex Chapman, and you know, he became one of kind of the best engineers around Augur. I'd say probably, in my opinion, probably the best smart contract engineer in the world. And he came, I think, from like Blizzard, from the game development space. My view on building companies, I would always want to hire as many game devs as possible because the work environment is basically torture. And so like you take a game developer who's like in crunch time, and then you pour them over to the startup world. And the startup world actually feels easier versus like you take somebody from Facebook, you know, they're used to like, you know, this kind of coddled life, which doesn't really jive too well with startups.
Right. And so maybe speak to the challenge, I guess, as it exists today around finding, you know, a really solid team. And did it feel at the time with Augur as though you were building a company, or did you feel as though you were building this kind of more decentralized kind of, I guess, platform for people to just sort of plug into and float in and out of?
Yeah, definitely a decentralized platform. Like, you know, I wouldn't say, we kind of always knew we weren't building like a traditional company. We were building like a protocol, this open source software project. I mean, we always referred to it as the project. Nobody ever said, you know, the company. And so that made it a bit of a different vibe than a traditional company. It's not like there's some person like me or somebody, you know, saying like, hey, you know, you have to do X, Y, and Z. It was much more kind of a bit laissez-faire. I would say there's like pros and cons of that. You really have to be careful about who you hire. Otherwise that can backfire pretty strongly because like, that can just cause problems. Like you need people who kind of get along very, very well. Otherwise teams like that don't work. I think that answers the question.
Sure. One thing we haven't covered actually is you're a Teal fellow. And I'm pretty dying to kind of hear about what that experience is like from the inside, because I've never really heard a good account of what the experience is like and what kind of how it all runs. Like, are you having lunch with Peter every fortnight, or what's the story?
Yeah, no. So, let's see. So the story behind that. So Vitalik got it before I did. He got a year or two before I did, and he actually suggested that I apply to it. I think I told him something like, no, like I'm so focused on like Augur, I don't want to take very much time to like apply to this thing. He's like, no, just do it. It won't take you more than 15 minutes. You just sit down and do the application. I said, okay. And so I did it. I applied for it. They basically just ask you questions about what you're working on, which is like easy. Didn't take very long because like, well, it's easy to talk about what I'm working on. I do that every day. And then so you submit this application, and then basically there's like sort of like an interview process. So they have like these offsites, usually in San Francisco, where you go. I think it's at the Founders Fund office or like the Thiel Capital office, something like that, usually probably Thiel Capital. And you go meet a bunch of people, you meet a bunch of other potential fellows, you meet some of the existing prior fellows, you meet a lot of people on the foundation, Thiel Fellowship Foundation or whatever it's called, the team there. And then you interview with historical fellows plus people who work at the foundation. And there's like multiple interview rounds. Usually you interview with former Thiel fellows first, and then like if they think you're solid, then you kind of interview with like the people on the foundation team. And then it's sort of like, then, you know, eventually they decide whether it makes sense for you to become a Thiel fellow or not. That's basically the process in a nutshell. The other thing is like, you know, what do you do after that? And it's like, well, they give you $100,000 with no strings attached. And then like, they're kind of always there. Like you can always call them if you need a connection to somebody or advice or help with something. Or the other big benefit, the biggest benefit I would say is just the other community of other Thiel fellows is really cool. Like every couple of years, there's like a, you know, offsite retreat where everybody, including a lot of the prior fellows, gets together for a few days. That's like always super exciting and fun. That's like the short version of it.
Sure. And it's hard to, I mean, at the start of this conversation, you were talking about how computers are probably, you know, the most, or, you know, writing software to achieve things is probably a high leverage way of affecting change in the world. It sounds like a fairly Peter Thielian kind of statement, if you don't mind me saying. So has he affected your thinking in any kind of particular way, or is he an influence in any specific way?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not like I, you know, sit down and talk to Peter all the time. I've only met him a couple of times. You know, but he's definitely very smart. You know, I think he's a really smart thinker. You know, I think the interesting thing with him and software is he's actually kind of, you usually see him in the press, he's kind of harping on like saying, you know, hey, like, you know, there used to be all this innovation in like hard things, like things in the physical world, and now it's just software. Like that's kind of lame. We should do other stuff. We should do other engineering stuff too. But I think you know, he's definitely right. In the sense that, you know, software is kind of the highest leverage way to create change in the world. Like that's something I think I probably first saw Peter mention that, or maybe Mark Andreessen. And it's something I totally agree with for sure.
Right. And then eventually, you know, you find your way as an investor, notwithstanding all of the progress made on Augur. Eventually you found yourself in an investing role. How did you kind of stumble into that role, and maybe give a bit of the story there?
Yeah. So like all good things in life, you stumble into them randomly. And from the investing side of things, so late 2015, early 2016, I remember seeing this company that back then I actually used Facebook. I remember seeing this company on Facebook called Numerai, because one of my friends had posted about it. And I was like, man, that company looks really cool. Like, I wish I could invest in it. But then I was like, oh, but wait, like, I don't really have any money. It's like, I don't know how to invest in companies. You don't have any money.
You're going to need that.
and so there turns out there's ways to get money if you don't have any, through like syndicates. So, you know, Naval created this great platform, AngelList, which has all these syndicates where you can basically raise money from other people, charge a fee on it, and deploy it into a company that you like. Then the next problem becomes, well, I don't know any people who want to give me money to then deploy it to invest in stuff. And so I went to Richard, the CEO of Numerai, with one of my friends, Henry Alt, and I, we met up with him. We basically told him like, hey, like, we think your company's really cool. We'll do anything you want to help. And like, we want to invest, but also we don't have any money. And surprisingly, he's like, okay. And so Henry hired him like his first two or three engineering hires. they ended up doing some stuff in crypto. I actually wrote their first set of smart contracts for the Numeraire token and staking system, gave them like a bunch of technical advice. And then Richard said, you know, hey, like, I got all these investors for this round because Union Square Ventures led a Series A in them, you know, but I don't want to, like, I don't want to deal with all these small investors on my cap table. How about I just give them to you in an angelist syndicate? You can invest all of them, you know, in one rolled up SPV, and it'll be one line item on our cap table. I said, sure. And that's how I started syndicating deals. So with Henry and I, we built our syndicate up into, I would say, probably in the top 10 or so by backing on angelist, just by doing more and more deals. And the next deal we did was a deal called 0x, the decentralized exchange. And that deal was a 100x cash on cash return in under 1 year to our LPs. Damn. And through 0x, wow, that's how I met Pantera.
Right. And I guess when you're generating those sort of returns, there must be something in like the way that you look at the market that sort of formulates your thesis for investing. Could you kind of describe how you look at the market and find these sort of like diamonds in the rough, I guess?
Yeah. So I mean, like, you know, 0x itself wasn't really a diamond in the rough. It's just like a new company, right? I guess every new company is like a needle in a haystack. You're trying to find the right one. And so for 0x, it was kind of coincidence. Linda Shee, which was Will's boyfriend at the time, worked at Coinbase. Somehow she joined the Augur Slack and sent me a message and said, hey, my boyfriend wants to meet you. Are you ever going to be in San Francisco sometime? And I was like, sure. And so I booked a flight to San Francisco, like I think a week or two from then, and went to the Coinbase offices and had lunch with Will. And like at the time, he was basically like, had all these ideas for like decentralized options protocols and all that kind of stuff. It was like, you know, do you think we should build this within Augur? Like, should I join Augur and we could build this together? And I was like, you know, I think like you should actually just start a company around this. It sounds really cool. Then he realized there's not really any good decentralized exchange. That's how early the space was. And so he's like, actually, we can just build that. I said, that sounds good to me. And we started kind of pinging ideas back and forth there. And eventually I ended up, you know, advising them and writing the first check in there and helping them kind of raise their seed round. And so it's sort of random. And then like, if you think about investing, you just basically want to put yourself in the position to benefit from like randomness or luck as much as possible. And so like you get deals from other investors, you get deals from other founders. And it's kind of just this virtuous cycle where if you help people out, you'll get more deals, you'll get better deals. And it kind of just compounds on itself, really.
Sure. And I guess the way that the market exists today, how do you kind of view the role of an investor specifically within the crypto environment? Because, you know, it's certainly not a traditional methodology building a platform like Augur, for example, to, you know, not a lot of the core business logic applies to the exact same way. So how do you kind of approach investing? What do you think the right role of an investor is within these environments?
Yeah, I think, you know, as an investor, actually on that question, do you mean like in terms of helping companies out or evaluating them?
Well, I guess a bit of both in many respects. It's difficult to kind of apply a traditional frame of reference for applying valuations to companies, just as it is difficult to kind of find a way that you can help as an investor. So I guess comment on both.
Yeah. So I think helping is easier. It's a shorter answer. You know, I think like for helping companies, you know, in the DeFi space, everybody needs help with like, you know, technical architecture, token design, you know, game theory, economic incentives, that kind of stuff. It's always fun to bounce ideas off of people. Everybody needs marketing. Everybody needs, you know, like strategy discussions. You always still have team dynamic problems or questions or challenges or hiring. All those things that you traditionally help a company with out still exist, even if it's like more of an open source project. Plus you have like these crypto specific things like the game theory and token design and all that stuff. I think in terms of evaluating projects, it's very similar to investing in early stage companies, you know, on the equity or venture side. I would say the one difference is that, you know, here the assets are public pretty close to day one. They're publicly tradable. So you need something that like, you need a strong community, I guess is the way I would phrase it. And that's just not true for like a B2B SaaS company where I'm selling, you know, software from one business to the next. Here, community is really important. And so like, if I see a team and, you know, it's a bunch of academics and none of them have ever built a community before, I might still invest in it if they're like super outgoing and I think they will be able to build a community. Like a good example of this actually is like the Arbitrum team, which we seeded. You know, like they're fairly academic guys, but like really smart, really outgoing, like totally likable. And like, I just know that they're going to build a strong community. And like, that's like the bet we made investing in them versus like, there's some academics who like, you know, they're great technically, but like you just couldn't foresee them building a community. It's like that type of person needs somebody else paired alongside them. And if they don't have it, you know, that's the deal where like most of the time, the best decision is to pass, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And do you think it's fair the amount of flack VCs get in the crypto community or just in general as well? Like you see it on Twitter all the time, everyone's sort of paying out VCs. What's your sort of take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mostly just people hate what they don't have. Like, so for instance, like, you know, if you see like a VC who's invested in some round of some company, you're like, damn, like I really wish I got to invest in that company. Then it's like the natural human psychology thing is to be like, man, like screw that VC. They're such a jerk. Like, you know, like they must be terrible. They're just taking away the investments from the common man or whatever. And it's like, mm-hmm. like not really like, you know, if you're upset about that stuff, like you should really talk, you know, talk to your congressman. Like it's the accredited investor laws that make this stuff stuck. It's not like, I guess it's like, that's like point A, I think. It's like, it's not investors' fault. The system is the way it is. It's kind of just like how it is. And then I think the second thing is that like having somebody who has your back and can support you and be there and like help you deal with all the bullshit that you have to deal with as a company is actually really important. And investors do provide that role. Like for instance, like I'm just not going to be able to call for 99.99% of people who bought in the Augur crowd sale. Like I can't just like call them up at 2 a.m. and be like, man, I have this huge problem. I need like your help solving it. Like, what should I do? But like our founders could totally call me at that time. And most of the time I'd still be awake and answer the phone. And so like, that's like the difference. And that's why founders do take investors' money. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And what do you think the role is of these DAOs like the Lao and Meta Cartel in sort of breaking down those barriers for the average retail investor to be able to get inside these sort of venture deals?
Yeah, I think that stuff is super cool. It's also cool because it provides like it's not like a legal entity, I don't think, but it provides an entity for the founder to interact with. So like, and I don't know like how much success they've actually had with this or not. I haven't like confirmed this or even asked the founder about it, but like whether this is true or not, you could envision a world where like a founder has Meta Cartel as an investor and they go to them and say like, hey, like we have this problem. And then like the DAO kind of routes the problem to the appropriate person within the DAO, who can then turn around and help the company with it. I don't know if that's actually how it works. I probably should know, but I don't. But like, if it did work that way, that would be cool. And that's a much better system than like just pure crowdfunding, in my opinion, because then like it actually maintains kind of the human relationship, which I think is important.
Yeah. And at the moment, I mean, for clarity, we're investors in the Lao and have been members from the start. And it's kind of clear that there's a certain kind of stamp of approval. It's kind of very fashionable to take investment from a DAO and people see the value on that basis. But I think definitely the next step is having that kind of division of labor. That's something that really hasn't been challenged, like divvying up work between the members, kind of saying, who's got expertise here? How can we help founder XYZ in this specific department? Just coming back to the community side. So what do you think the really important characteristics for any founders listening are for building that initial community? I know it's a really open question. It's one that everyone's kind of looking for an answer to. In your experience, what do you think are the really important characteristics of successful community builders?
Yeah, I think successful community builders, they know how to write. Like they're very good and clear at writing. That's really important. Like even if you look at somebody like, you know, SBF from FTX or whatever, he writes like all the time. I don't think their exchange would be nearly as popular or that he would have nearly as big of a following if he didn't have like those long Twitter threads that he tweets. I think that's actually like, it's like a small thing that actually matters. That's like the first thing. I think the second thing is like, you need people who understand like what drives the community. So like, if you don't understand like what gets your community excited, you're not going to build a community that keeps growing. You're just going to have like this kind of hodgepodge of random people who don't really like jive well. Like it's like the classic example of this is like Chainlink has a very strong community. Like they've coalesced around like a certain set of memes, happen to be frog memes. But like the point is like it actually works. And so like that's like the second thing. I think the third thing is probably just like there needs to be like a reason like why does the community exist? It's kind of like really, really important. And so like if you look at something like Ethereum, like there's a lot of answers you could give for that. One of them would be like, well, Ethereum's a community of people who are excited about decentralizing finance, making it more global, lower cost, you know, 24/7, lower frictions, all that stuff. And if you don't have a good answer to that, your community is not going to be as strong, or it's just going to be like a bunch of shills that like don't really understand what they're even talking about, but are still super excited about it. And those types of things tend to fade over time.
Sure. And I guess lines can be blurred between, I guess, core contributors and community members in many respects. So I guess what are the sort of key characteristics of like finding the core contributors? Let's say that I have a new idea for a decentralized project. How should I go and find, you know, the right initial core team members? Where should I look?
Yeah, I mean, I think for initial core team members, I mean, one place you can look is like, you know, in like the chat rooms of other projects. Like I know people who've hired people from chat rooms. They've met them and they've, you know, done some development work together or whatever. I think the other thing is like if you're like in really new team, you know, like seed stage or whatever, building a protocol, it's not like some decentralized thing yet, you know, then you can like just literally go to like recruiters and stuff and have like a hiring funnel and build a pipeline and do all the normal stuff there. You know, I think one thing that's really important is to have like some sort of coding test if you're hiring engineers. There's just so much noise that it's really tough to find people. And like, for instance, like I remember one time I interviewed I won't name the university, so he's not doxed, but I interviewed a professor at a university, professor of computer science, and like he couldn't pass like my Solidity coding test, which like anybody who spent like more than 5 hours of Solidity should be able to pass it. And mm-hmm. His code just didn't work. And so like coding tests are a great way to filter out candidates, I think.
Or just hire game developers.
Yes. Or just hire game developers. Like seriously, that's the best secret in hiring engineers.
Yeah. So I've never been a game developer myself. What is it about being a game developer, working on a game that is so intense that you just find them to be the best people to work with?
Yeah. I think, at some game development firms, like this has changed a little bit, but like, and that's why you see sometimes games are more buggy when they ship, because they just like say, well, we'll just fix it in post, and you know, they'll ship updates after. But in the old days, for sure, like when you shipped a game, like it had to be pretty damn near perfect by the launch date, because you would roll out the gold release, you know, the DVDs or whatever, have the game on it. And if it was like broken, like that was it. Like you couldn't ship an update. Like you think about like the Xbox One or the original Xbox era, you know, like when Halo rolled out, like it had to be good, because you couldn't update it. Xbox Live didn't even exist at launch, I don't think. And so with that in mind, you can envision that game development companies set deadlines for like when the game's going to launch. And then like, unlike most of software development, you can't always just like push the deadline off. Like you can sometimes, and sometimes you see that happen, games get delayed forever. But a lot of the time, like you'll actually just have to hit the deadline, and come hell or high water, you'll hit the deadline. And so like it's a really brutal process. Like when you have crunch time for like launching a video game, you have people who might be working 100, 120 hour weeks. It's like literally insane. And so if you take that person, shove them into a startup environment where they're working like 75, 80 hour weeks, it feels like smooth. Like it's like, it's like going from like, you know, driving some really, you know, custom Ferrari to like driving like a Lexus in automatic. It's like an SUV. Like it just feels easy to them because like they've been through hell so much on the game development side. And then usually like people perceive these people as like 10x engineers because like that's where they come from. But like that's not like, not every game developer is that way. Like you still have to like hire, you know, the right people and all that stuff. But it's just something I've noticed.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a game development background? Is that how you know so much
about this? No, I've written like a couple of small games, but no, I don't. I don't have a game development background.
Yeah, I guess on the deadline point, it seems like there's a pretty close analog to shipping to mainnet as well. Do you think that that's true?
Yeah, I think that's true. Although I think in crypto, like people tend to you know push deadlines off a bit more. You know, than you would in game dev, but I think that's true. And then also when you ship to mainnet, it does have to be right. That's the other thing that's similar. Like, yeah.
Yeah, you can't really get around bugs.
Yeah, you have to ship it right the first time.
Right. So just coming back, I guess, to the personal sort of investment thesis side, I guess it's always probably useful to kind of understand how you probably think about the market and how you contextualize where we are at in terms of Web3 and where we're at in terms of the actual Web3 stack. How do you contextualize what new developments need to occur and what, I guess, needs to be built in future?
Yeah, I think on the Web3 stack, I think it's further behind than DeFi, like in terms of what needs to be built. If you think of like, it's kind of like a really rough analogy, but if you think of like Ethereum as being like the key platform for DeFi, maybe something like Filecoin or Arweave or both of them or whatever, the key platforms for Web3. And those kind of just launched fairly recently. And so there's like that. And then in terms of Web3 applications, I think the application side is just much earlier. The first one that's got any decent user numbers that I've seen is like BitClout, but it's not like fully decentralized yet or anything like that. And that's kind of like the very first thing, similar to how like in DeFi, like in late 2017, Maker launched, and that was kind of the first like pure DeFi app. Maybe BitClout will become that, but it's still very early. As far as what needs to exist, I think it's just like faster infrastructure and like more scalable infra. Like you probably couldn't, in my opinion, build like Facebook on Filecoin today, and like maybe you will be able to someday. But the scale is just not there yet on Web3.
Mm-hmm. And is that sort of the area that you're looking to invest with Pantera Capital?
Yeah. So we'll definitely look at Web3 stuff. We're investors in Filecoin. We're also investors in Arweave. I don't think we've invested in, actually, we've invested in one thing on the application layer, which is kind of cool. Audius, which is like this kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. audio streaming site, kind of like decentralized SoundCloud. That's probably the main one. There may be one or two I'm forgetting, but we haven't done a lot yet, but we look to do more in the future.
Sure. Other than that, I think, yeah. Where can people go and find you, Joey?
They can find me on Twitter at Joey Krug on Twitter. If you want to send me an email, it's just joey@pantera.com. That's pretty much it.
Great. Well, thanks for the time.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And that marks the end of our episode at High Definition. If you want to find out more about our guests, visit our website at koji.capital. And if you're a founder looking for funding or support, reach out to us via Twitter at kojicapital or through email hello@koji.capital. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the next episode.